How can a microchip manufacturer keep track of 250 million control points at once?
How can technology behind animated movies help enterprises reimagine their future?
Built for Change listeners know those answers and more. I'm Elise Hu.
And I'm Josh Klein. We're the hosts of Built for Change, a podcast from Accenture.
We talk to leaders of the world's biggest companies to hear how they've reinvented their business to create industry-shifting impact.
And how you can, too.
New episodes are coming soon, so check out Built for Change wherever you get your podcasts.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, there's a battle being waged on college campuses over freedom of speech. And this time, conservatives say they're the ones being silenced. And why Marine Le Pen's resounding defeat in France's presidential election could be seen as a victory for her right-wing party. It's Monday, May 8th.
At a lot of college campuses, there is not just a resistance.
Shut it down.
What you're seeing on college campuses is actually more of a form of censorship of ideas.
Those violent protests erupting overnight at UC Berkeley, the campus locked down as more than 1,000 people rallied against the appearance of a controversial editor from Breitbart, Milo Yiannopoulos.
And an unwillingness for these students to, and in some cases faculty, allow a point of view to be expressed that they find uncomfortable.
For decades, college liberals have claimed the moral high ground when it comes to freedom of speech. But my colleague Jeremy Peters has been reporting on a striking reversal on campuses across the country. Conservatives are accusing liberals of trying to prevent them from expressing any idea they find offensive.
Murray is known for writing The Bell Curve. It's a book that's caused a bit of controversy for linking intelligence to class and race.
That came to a head back in March on the campus of Middlebury College in Vermont.
Protesters basically say Murray's research is bogus because he's racist, while others say Murray is simply presenting the hard truths from his research.
As has often been the case when conservative speakers show up on liberal college campuses these days,
hundreds of students and community members met up here at the Student Center to protest Charles Murray.
Charles Murray was met by a group of demonstrators.
It was
a really beautiful moment of, like, community building.
It was a mess.
My name is Liz Dunn. I'm a junior gender, sexuality, and feminism studies major at Middlebury College.
My name is Hayden DuBois, and I'm the co-president of the Middlebury College Republicans. The day of, we were initially expecting there to be some sort of walkout protest, and we were all mistaken.
Noise or action that disrupts the ability of the audience.
The room was completely flooded. Probably 75% of the room was protesters. We're talking about a couple hundred.
If an event is disrupted by a group or individual, a representative of the college may request the action to stop or ask the person or group to leave the event.
Even before Murray got up, the student speakers who were introducing him,
that Middlebury can truly live up to its claim to be a place of the liberal arts.
Of academia.
A place for liberal thought, liberal action, and liberal speech.
For inclusivity!
They were all being booed and chanted down by the protesters.
I invite you today to express your opinions.
These are truths!
And invite you to welcome with me
we won't.
This evening's speaker, Dr. Charles Murray.
Once he took the stage,
I had thoughts before I started.
The main person in charge of, like, that particular part of the protest stood up.
There is not potential for equal exchange of ideas!
Which indicated for everybody else to stand up, turn around, and begin reading simultaneously the letter we wrote.
Most important must be spoken, made verbal and shared, even at the risk of having it bruised or misunderstood.
It basically said that students at Middlebury College were not going to accept white supremacy on our campus. We're not going to accept misogyny on our campus, that this is something that we've been experiencing here, and also like outside of Middlebury, and that we would not allow somebody to come here and continue to say these things and be given a platform and not respond in some way.
In this world today, there's little that's true facts. History speaks volumes.
It wasn't saying at all, we're going to silence you. It was just saying we have the right to speak back.
It had to do with oppression and racism and then doing, you know, rehearsed shouting and, you know, Charles Murray, go away.
Racist, sexist, anti-gay.
Calling him a racist, eugenicist. He really didn't have any opportunity to speak on stage.
I watched him walk off stage, and then our head of communications came up and announced that there would be a live stream in a private location.
Anyone who wants to watch it, listen to it.
We initiated what was the plan B, to move Murray and Professor Allison Stanger, who was moderating the event, to a secure location where they could be live streamed so the event could still take place.
I spent a lot of time preparing really hard questions. We're going to have a great dialogue if you let us continue.
There are fire alarms that were scattered throughout the building that houses the auditorium. And so some protesters went, found the fire alarms, and began to pull them, which had two effects. Number one, essentially made everything inaudible. But number two, it killed non-essential power to the building. And therefore, it killed the live stream. So it took...
It's also, of course, illegal to pull a fire alarm when there's no fire.
Absolutely. It is. And it happened three times throughout the evening until eventually I was just so dissatisfied, because every time the fire alarm got pulled, it shut everything down for about 10, 15 minutes before they could get the system online. They would pull it again. And it was just a recurring nightmare, sort of.
I don't know if this is like cosmic irony, but the entire Supreme Court case about free speech includes the admonition not to yell fire in a crowded room. And what is pulling a fire alarm if not?
That's the irony.
Did Charles Murray get to speak in that room, do you recall?
Charles Murray did not speak.
Something has really changed in our political discourse, and I know it's almost become a cliche to say how uncivil politics has become, but what you see often at events like this is speakers are shouted down. Sometimes they're not even allowed to speak. This one turned violent and ended up with the professor who was accompanying Charles Murray at Middlebury having to go to the hospital because somebody yanked her and injured her neck. Sometimes the uprising becomes so severe and hostile that they have to cancel their events.
Good morning. Well, it was, of course, here on the Berkeley campus that the free speech movement was born in the 1960s. Now Ann Coulter is battling to be heard here after the university rescheduled a speech planned for this week.
And that's exactly what happened at Berkeley with Ann Coulter recently.
Jeremy, at the heart of all of this is the concept and the question of free speech.
Well, I wanted to speak.
And you spoke at length with Ann Coulter while reporting this story.
Each requirement they put on me, I kept saying, no, I want to give this speech. I give speeches all the time. They're fun. I like them. I like having liberals in the audience.
What does Ann Coulter say about freedom of speech right now in this current climate, especially on campuses?
I am often the only conservative kids are going to hear in 4 years of college. I know that.
Ann is someone who would consider herself one of the conservatives who believes that the left engages in a measure of thought policing, that it doesn't have, you know, the tolerance it professes to have for ideas, that it selectively applies those principles of tolerance and excludes conservatives from that and conservative ideas from that.
You shut down argument by saying, oh, my feelings are hurt. It's because it's easy and it's lazy.
And this is when we start getting into like the snowflakes and safe spaces aspect of all of this. They conservatives like Ann Coulter kind of have a certain like give me a break reaction to the hypersensitivity that they see in a lot of younger people, a lot of liberal Americans, and especially as that plays out on college campuses.
No smart person would attach themselves to this identity politics. You'd have the argument.
When did you first notice a change, that the debate started becoming more about shutting down the debate instead of having it, even on the ugliest of terms?
I hate when people say this, and that's why I'm really mulling it. But I am pretty sure it's never been like this before. I've been giving college speeches for a long time.
Jeremy, where do we believe, and where do historians and your reporting make you think that this idea that if you don't like someone else's speech, you shut it down? Where did that start?
Well, I feel like a lot of them believe that it grew out of what they would see as the excessively politically correct culture of the 90s and 2000s.
Sexism in any context is never appropriate. Yes.
But what about our charcoal technique? Oh.
Don't change the subject here, sir. This class is a travesty. That poor woman child is just another victim of the patriarchy.
She is?
I am.
Hate crime. Hate crime.
It culminated in a few high-profile incidents around university commencement speakers.
70,000 petitions delivered to MSU leaders today to disinvite George Will.
Calling for a controversial commencement speaker to be taken off the program this Saturday.
The worst example of which conservatives believe was when Condoleezza Rice.
As a group of students, and I'm referring to the group of students protesting, we felt that war criminals shouldn't be honored by our university.
Pulled out of speaking at Rutgers because there was such a fierce backlash.
And we are proud that our direct actions and our pressure were felt and our voices were heard from the bottom up.
And over the last couple of years, we've seen a new spark lit. So you had the University of Missouri, where the president was forced to resign under pressure after students protested that he had not done enough to address some racially charged incidents on campus.
Hey, who wants to help me get this reporter out of here? I need some muscle over here.
Yeah, and then at Yale, there are these intense confrontations after a professor wrote a letter saying that it's just not the faculty's place to be telling students what they can and can't wear on Halloween, no matter how offensive.
By sending out that email, that goes against your position as master. Do you understand that?
Then no, I stop. Don't agree with that.
Then why the did you accept the position?
Because
who hired you?
I have a different vision.
You should step down.
A lot of Americans looked at these uprisings and didn't see persecuted students or minority groups. They saw an excessively sensitive and reactionary left wing. This notion that
you should not sleep at night. We're out. You are disgusting.
And in the midst of all this is President Donald Trump.
I think the big problem this country has is being politically correct.
Donald Trump is somebody who was elected in large part because he is extravagantly politically incorrect. And with his hostility toward protest groups, especially ones like Black Lives Matter.
You see them marching, and you see them on occasion, at least, I've seen it, where they're essentially calling death to the police.
Only made things worse on college campuses.
Is there any validity to the argument that these campuses have been ruled for so long, generally by a white, male-dominated community that didn't appreciate all the subtle and not subtle ways in which their style of leadership and their ideas oppressed a lot of other people, that has to be factored in as these sensitivities are now elevated?
Yes. I mean, that's a crux of this. That's the thrust of this debate right now, is that should your experience as somebody who comes from a background that is not privileged, should that experience give you the right to say, I find what you have to say and what you believe so deeply offensive that I'm going to fight to have it excised from the public square?
My experience here as like a queer Black woman and like a small white liberal arts college, I don't feel as if I have the ability to speak freely. I don't feel as if my voice is heard or as if it is weighed with the same value as the voices of other people simply because of identity. So I think that free speech on a small college campus can be a very different experience depending on who you are and where you're coming from. But I, and as evidenced by the protests, a pretty large group of other people do definitely feel as if not everybody has the ability to speak freely.
I think there are legitimate objections to the things that Murray wrote about, particularly in The Bell Curve. And I think I personally strongly disagree with the things that he wrote. But, you know, I think it was Voltaire who said, you know, disagree with what you have to say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. So I disagree with what he said. And I understand the protesters who strongly disagree and feel offended by some of his writings. But the one thing I can't sympathize with is the feeling that they have, they're entitled to be able to shut down an event because they disagree, or silence a speaker because they disagree. And I think the more we continue down this path of trying to silence each other rather than listen to each other, the more dangerous we move towards losing free speech as a fundamental value. And that's dangerous. I mean, it's free speech needs to be preserved for the journalist, for the conservative, for the liberal, for the protester, but also for the speaker. We need to recognize it's a fundamental value, and we've lost sight of that. And I think it's becoming limited in ways that truly frighten me.
I think one of the issues is that free speech is sort of this arbitrary switch that any administration in power can turn on and off when it coincides with their personal political values. So Charles Murray wasn't silenced because he was saying something that, regardless of what other administrators or faculty or staff may have said, was validated by the institution. And that's why he was allowed to speak. So I think that Charles Murray is doing just fine. And I don't think that his free speech was violated in the same way that people with less power are experiencing this situation.
As a final question, in the United States, have we lost our kind of common understanding of free speech on both sides?
I actually don't believe that there ever was a common understanding of free speech. I think that one group that was in power put forward a definition and other groups didn't have the ability to debate that. And I think that now we're actually reaching a point where enough people have gotten enough of a voice to start to push back against dominant ideas of what free speech is and what free speech should be. And I think that's why there's a lot of this tension right now. It's not because all of a sudden there are a lot of disagreements or people are feeling way more sensitive. It's just because for the first time in history, people are actually able to speak. That's just kind of why there's finally disagreement, because people have been saying this all along. They just haven't actually had the ability to make it heard.
In response to what's happened at places like Berkeley and Middlebury, a handful of states, including North Carolina, Tennessee, and Illinois, are now considering legislation that would protect free speech at colleges. The laws would include measures like preventing administrators from disinviting speakers and punishing students who interfere with the speeches. We'll be right back.
I'm Shane Goldmacher. I'm a national political correspondent for The New York Times, covering the 2024 election. I have off and on for years covered the role of money in politics, and that means sifting through tens of thousands of line items in campaign reports, looking at who's getting paid, how much they're getting paid, who's donating to these campaigns, who's reserved the most ads on Google, who's this billionaire changing the shape of the race with a single check. Look, the campaign spin, the strategists tell you one thing, the numbers don't really lie, and those numbers help us ask the right questions. That's what's so special about the New York Times. We get to tap the collective knowledge and wisdom of my colleagues who have expertise in every nook and cranny of this country and this campaign trail to tell you the full story of what's happening in these critical moments in the last few weeks of the election. If this kind of coverage is important to you, you can support it by subscribing to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here is what else you need to know today.
Merci, mes amis.
Emmanuel Macron, the 39-year-old centrist candidate with little political experience, was elected president of France on Sunday in a decisive victory over the far-right candidate Marine Le Pen. Le Pen's loss is being taken as a sign that a surge of political populism starting with Brexit and President Trump's election may not be as powerful as some had predicted. Still, even in defeat, Le Pen has achieved a kind of victory for her party, the National Front. My colleague Alyssa Rubin explains from Paris.
I think we have to put it in the perspective of the overall progress of the National Front. The National Front was for a long time, a very small, very marginal force in France. And it has really grown into almost an opposition party. So although her father managed to make it to the second round of the French elections in 2002, that was almost a sort of fluke. And he got about half the number of votes that she's gotten. So I think in many ways, extreme parties, all parties, can grow very slowly if they don't have a base that they're growing out of, and hers really has been built from the ground up. So from that point of view, she did quite well. From the point of view of winning an election, obviously she did terribly because the margin was so large. But I do think one has to look at the totality and ask oneself, well, is this the end? Can she not get any more than about 35% of the vote? Or will she be able to build on this or remake her party in yet another way that adds more votes? So next time it's 45 and the time after it's 55.
And what do you think the answer is?
I think it depends how successful Macron is at actually getting through a program and how successful that program is in ameliorating some of people's economic distress and sense of stasis and of not moving forward.
In her concession speech on Sunday night,
chers compatriotes de métropole, d'outre-mer et de l'étranger,
Le Pen said that France had chosen continuity over change, and she congratulated Macron, saying, quote, I have the interest of the country at heart.
Plus que jamais dans les mois qui viennent, la France aura besoin de vous. Vive la République, vive la France.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.